Chapter 3. A Meeting on the Road. 1. She had never in her life had such a strange night, and it was probably not surprising that she didn't hear the rider approaching from behind until he was almost upon her. The thing that troubled her most as she made her way back toward town was her new understanding of the compact she had made. It was good to have a reprieve, months yet before she would have to live up to her end of the bargain. But a reprieve didn't change the basic fact. When the demon moon was full, she would lose her virginity to Mayor Thorin, a skinny, twitchy man with fluffy white hair rising like a cloud around the bald spot on top of his head, a man whose wife regarded him with a certain weary sadness that was painful to look at. Hart Thorin was a man who laughed uproariously when a company of players put on an entertainment involving head-knocking or pretend-punching or rotten fruit-throwing, but who only looked puzzled at a story which was pathetic or tragical. A knuckle-cracker, a back-slapper, a dinner-table belcher, a man who had a way of looking anxiously toward his chancellor at almost every other word, as if to make sure he hadn't offended Rhymer in some way. Susan had observed all these things often. Her father had for years been in charge of the barony's horse, and had gone to Seafront often on business. Many times he had taken his much-loved daughter with him. Oh, she had seen a lot of Hart Thorin over the years, and he had seen a lot of her as well. Too much, mayhap. For what now seemed the most important fact about him was that he was almost 50 years older than the girl who would perhaps bear his son. She had made the bargain lightly enough. No, not lightly, that was being unfair to herself. But she had lost little sleep over it, that much was true. She had thought, after listening to all Aunt Cord's arguments, well, it's little enough, really, to have the indenture off the lands, to finally own our little piece of the drop, in fact as well as in tradition, to actually have papers, one in our house and one in Rhymer's files, saying it's ours. Aye, and to have horses again. Only 3, 'tis true, but that's 3 more than we have now. And against that? To lie with him a time or two, and to bear a child, which millions of women have done before me with no harm. 'Tis not, after all, a mutant or a leper I'm being asked to partner with, but just an old man with noisy knuckles. 'Tis not forever, and as Aunt Cord says, I may still marry, if time and God decree. I should not be the first woman to come to her husband's bed as a mother. And does it make me a whore to do such? The law says not. But never mind that. My heart's law is what matters. And my heart says that if I may gain the land that was my dad's, and 3 horses to run on it by being such, then it's a whore I'll be. There was something else. Aunt Cord had capitalized rather ruthlessly, Susan now saw, on a child's innocence. It was the baby, Aunt Cord had harped on, the cunning little baby she would have. Aunt Cord had known that Susan, the dolls of her childhood put aside not all that long ago, would love the idea of her own baby, a little living doll to dress and feed and sleep with in the heat of the afternoon. What Cordelia had ignored, perhaps she's too innocent even to have considered it, Susan thought, but didn't quite believe, was what the hag woman had made brutally clear to her this evening. Thorin wanted more than a child.
He wants tits and ass that don't squish in his hands, and a box that'll grip what he pushes.
Just thinking of those words made her face throb as she walked through the post-moonset dark toward town. No high-spirited running this time, no singing either. She had agreed with vague thoughts of how managed livestock mated. They were allowed to go at it until the seed took, then separated again. But now she knew that Thorin might want her again and again, probably would want her again and again, and common law going back like iron for 200 generations said that he could continue to lie with her until she who had proved the consort honest should prove her honestly with child as well. And that child honest in and of itself, not that was a mutant aberration. Susan had made discreet inquiries and knew that this second proving usually came around the 4th month of pregnancy, around the time she would begin to show, even with her clothes on. It would be up to Rhea to make the judgment, and Rhea didn't like her. Now that it was too late, Now that she had accepted the compact formerly tendered by the Chancellor, now that she had been proved honest by yon strange bitch, she rued the bargain. Mostly what she thought of was how Thorin would look with his pants off, his legs white and skinny like the legs of a stork, and how, as they lay together, she would hear his long bones crackling, knees and back and elbows and neck. And knuckles. Don't forget his knuckles. Yes, big old man's knuckles with hair growing out of them. Susan chuckled at the thought. It was that comical. But at the same time, a warm tear ran unnoticed from the corner of one eye and tracked down her cheek. She wiped it away without knowing it, any more than she heard the clip-clop of approaching hoofs in the soft road dust. Her mind was still far away, returning to the odd thing she had seen through the old woman's bedroom window. The soft but somehow unpleasant light coming from the pink globe, the hypnotized way the hag had been looking down at it. When Susan at last heard the approaching horse, her first alarmed thought was that she must get into the copse of trees she was currently passing and hide. The chances of anyone above board being on the road this late seemed small to her, especially now that such bad times had come to Midworld. But it was too late for that. The ditch, then, and sprawled flat. With the moon down, there was at least a chance that whoever it was would pass without... But before she could even begin in that direction, the rider who had sneaked up behind her while she was thinking her long and rueful thoughts had hailed her. "Good even, lady, and may your days be long upon the earth." She turned, thinking, what if it's one of the new men always lounging about Mayor's house or in the Traveler's Rest? Not the oldest one, the voice isn't wavery like his, but maybe one of the others. It could be the one they called De Pape. "Good even," she heard herself saying to the man-shape on the tall horse. "May yours be long also." Her voice didn't tremble, not that she could hear. She didn't think it was De Pape, or the one named Reynolds, either. The only thing she could tell about the fellow for sure was that he wore a flat-brimmed hat, the sort she associated with men of the inner baronies, back when travel between East and West had been more common than it was now. Back before John Farson came, the good man, and the bloodletting began. As the stranger came up beside her, she forgave herself a little for not hearing him approach. There was no buckle or bell on his gear that she could see, and everything was tied down so as not to snap or flap. It was almost the rig of an outlaw, or a harrier. She had the idea that Jonas, he of the wavery voice, and his two friends might have been both in other times and other climes. Or even a gunslinger. But this man bore no guns, unless they were hidden. A bow on the pommel of his saddle, and what looked like a lance in a scabbard, that was all. And there had never, she reckoned, been a gunslinger as young as this. He clucked side-mouth at the horse, just as her dad had always done, and she herself, of course, and it stopped at once. As he swung one leg over his saddle, lifting it high and with unconscious grace, Susan said, "Nay, nay, don't trouble yourself, stranger, but go as you would." If he heard the alarm in her voice, he paid no heed to it. He slipped off the horse, not bothering with the tied-down stirrup, and landed neatly in front of her, the dust of the road puffing about his square-toed boots. By starlight she saw that he was young indeed, close to her own age, on one side or the other. His clothes were those of a working cowboy, although new. "Will Dearborn at your service," he said, then doffed his hat, extended a foot on one boot heel, and bowed as they did in the inner baronies. Such absurd courtliness out here in the middle of nowhere, with the acrid smell of the oil patch on the edge of town already in her nostrils, startled her out of her fear and into a laugh. She thought it would likely offend him, but he smiled instead. A good smile, honest and artless, its inner part lined with even teeth. She dropped him a little curtsy, holding out one side of her dress. "Susan Delgado, at yours." He tapped his throat thrice with his right hand. "Thank ye, sigh, Susan Delgado. We're well met, I hope. I didn't mean to startle you."
"Ye did, a little."
"Yes, I thought I had. I'm sorry." "Yes, not I, but yes. A young man from the inner baronies, by the sound." She looked at him with new interest.
"Nay, you need not apologize, for I was deep in my own thoughts," she said. "I'd been to see a friend and hadn't realized how much time had passed until I saw the moon was down. If you stopped out of concern, I thank you, stranger, but you may be on your way as I would be on mine. It's only to the edge of the village I go. Hambry, it's close now."
"Pretty speech and lovely sentiments," he answered with a grin. "But it's late, you're alone, and I think we may as well pass on together. You ride, Si?"
"Yes, but really step over and meet my friend Rusher, then. He shall carry you the last 2 miles. He's gelded, Si, and gentle."
She looked at Will Dearborn with a mixture of amusement and irritation. The thought which crossed her mind was, if he calls me Si again, as though I were a schoolteacher or his doddery old great-aunt, I'm going to take off this stupid apron and swat him with it.
"I never minded a bit of temper and a horse docile enough to wear a saddle. Until his death, my father managed the mayor's horses, and the mayor in these parts is also guard of barony. I've ridden my whole life."
She thought he might apologize, perhaps even stutter, but he only nodded with a calm thoughtfulness that she rather liked. "Then step to the stirrup, my lady. I'll walk beside and trouble you with no conversation if you'd rather not have it. It's late, and talk palls after moonset, some say." She shook her head, softening her refusal with a smile.
"Nay, I thank you for your kindness, but it would not be well, mayhap, for me to be seen riding a strange young man's horse at 11 o'clock. Lemon juice won't take the stain out of a lady's reputation the way it will out of a shirtwaist, you know."
"There's no one out here to see you," the young man said in a maddeningly reasonable voice. "And that you're tired, I can tell.
Come, Si, please don't call me that. It makes me feel as ancient as a—"
She hesitated for a brief moment, rethinking the word which, that first came to her mind.
"As an old woman."
"Miss Delgado, then. Are you sure you won't ride?"
"Sure as can be. I'd not ride cross-saddle in a dress in any case, Mr. Dearborn, not even if you were my own brother. 'Twouldn't be proper."
He stood in the stirrup himself, reached over to the far side of his saddle. Rusher stood docilely enough at this, only flicking his ears, which Susan would have been happy to flick herself had she been Rusher, they were that beautiful, and stepped back down with a rolled garment in his hands. It was tied with a rawhide hank. She thought it was a poncho. "You may spread this over your lap and legs, like a duster," he said. "There's quite enough of it for decorum's sake. It was my father's, and he's taller than me." He looked off toward the western hills for a moment, and she saw he was handsome, in a hard sort of way that jagged against his youth. She felt a little shiver inside her, and wished for the 1000th time that the foul old woman had kept her hands strictly on her business, as unpleasant as that business had been. Susan didn't want to look at this handsome stranger and remember Rhea's touch.
"Nay," she said gently, "thank ye again. I recognize your kindness, but I must refuse."
"Then I'll walk along beside, and Rusher'll be our chaperone," he said cheerfully. "As far as the edge of town, at least, there'll be no eyes to see and think ill of a perfectly proper young woman and a more or less proper young man. And once there, I'll tip my hat and wish you a very good night."
"I wish you wouldn't, really."
She brushed a hand across her forehead.
"Easy for you to say there are no eyes to see, but sometimes there are eyes even where there shouldn't be, and my position is a little delicate just now."
"I'll walk with you, however," he repeated, and now his face was somber. "These are not good times, Miss Delgado. Here in Magus you are far from the worst of the troubles, but sometimes trouble reaches out." She opened her mouth to protest again, she supposed, perhaps to tell him that Pat Delgado's daughter could take care of herself. And then she thought of the mayor's new men, and the cold way they had run their eyes over her when Thorin's attention had been elsewhere. She had seen those three this very night as she left on her way to the witch's hut. Them she had heard approaching, and in plenty of time for her to leave the road and rest behind a handy pinon tree. She refused to think of it as hiding, exactly.
Back toward town they had gone, and she supposed they were drinking at the Traveler's Rest right now, and would continue to until Stanley Ruiz closed the bar. But she had no way of knowing that for sure. They could come back. "If I can't dissuade you, very well," she said, sighing with a vexed resignation she didn't really feel. "But only to the first mailbox, Mrs. Beach's. That marks the edge of town." He tapped his throat again and made another of those absurd, enchanting bows, foot stuck out as if he would trip someone, heel planted in the dirt. "Thank ye, Miss Delgado." At least he didn't call me Cy, she thought. That's a start. 2. She thought he'd chatter away like a magpie in spite of his promise to be silent, because that was what boys did around her. She was not vain of her looks, but she thought she was good-looking, if only because the boys could not shut up or stop shuffling their feet when they were around her. And this one would be full of questions the town boys didn't need to ask. How old was she? Had she always lived in Hambry? Were her parents alive? 60 others, just as boring. But they would all circle in on the same one. Did she have a steady fellow? But Will Dearborn of the Inner Baronies didn't ask her about her schooling or family or friends, the most common way of approaching any romantic rival she had found. Will Dearborn simply walked along beside her, one hand wrapped around Rusher's bridle, looking off east toward the clean sea. They were close enough to it now so that the teary smell of salt mingled with the tarry stench of oil, even though the wind was from the south. They were passing Sitgo now, and she was glad for Will Dearborn's presence, even if his silence was a little irritating. She had always found the oil patch with its skeletal forest of gantries a little spooky. Most of those steel towers had stopped pumping long since, and there was neither the parts, the need, nor the understanding to repair them. And those which did still labor along, 19 out of about 200, could not be stopped. They just pumped and pumped, the supplies of oil beneath them seemingly inexhaustible. A little was still used, but a very little. Most simply ran back down into the wells beneath the dead pumping stations. The world had moved on, and this place reminded her of a strange mechanical graveyard where some of the corpses hadn't quite... Something cold and smooth nuzzled the small of her back, and she wasn't quite able to stifle a little shriek. Will Dearborn wheeled toward her, his hands dropping toward his belt. Then he relaxed and smiled. Rusher's way of saying he feels ignored. "I'm sorry, Miss Delgado." She looked at the horse. Rusher looked back mildly, then dipped his head, as if to say he was also sorry for having startled her. "Foolishness, girl," she thought, hearing the hearty, no-nonsense voice of her father. "He wants to know why you're being so standoffy, that's all. And so do I. 'Tisn't like you. No, it's not."
"Mr. Dearborn, I've changed my mind," she said. "I'd like to ride."
3. He turned his back and stood looking out at Sitgo with his hands in his pockets, while Susan first laid the poncho over the cantle of the saddle, the plain black saddle of a working cowboy, without a barony brand or even a ranch brand to mark it, and then mounted into the stirrup. She lifted her skirt and glanced around sharply, sure he would be stealing a peek. But his back was still to her. He seemed fascinated with the rusty oil derricks.
"What's so interesting about them, Cully?" she thought, a trifle crossly. It was the lateness of the hour, and the residue of her stirred-up emotion, she supposed. "Filthy old things have been there 6 centuries and more, and I've been smelling their stink my whole life." "Stand easy now, my boy," she said, once she had her foot fixed in the stirrup. One hand held the top of the saddle's pommel, the other the reins.
Rusher, meanwhile, flicked his ears, as if to say he would stand easy all night, were that what she required.
She swung up, one long bare thigh flashing in the starlight, and felt the exhilaration of being horsed that she always felt. Only tonight it seemed a little stronger, a little sweeter, a little sharper. Perhaps because the horse was such a beauty. Perhaps because the horse was a stranger. Perhaps because the horse's owner is a stranger, she thought, and fair.
That was nonsense, of course, and potentially dangerous nonsense. Yet it was also true. He was fair. As she opened the poncho and spread it over her legs, Dearborn began to whistle, and she realized with a mixture of surprise and superstitious fear what the tune was. Careless Love, the very lay she had been singing on her way up to Rhea's hut.
"Mayhap it's car, girl," her father's voice whispered.
"No such thing," she thought right back at him. "I'll not see Ka in every passing wind and shadow, like the old ladies who gather in Green Heart of a summer's evening. It's an old tune, everyone knows it."
"Mayhap better if you're right," Pat Delgado's voice returned. "For if it's Ka, it'll come like a wind, and your plans will stand before it no more than my dad's barn stood before the cyclone when it came."
Not Ka. She would not be seduced by the dark and the shadows and the grim shapes of the oil derricks into believing it was. Not Ka, but only a chance meeting with a nice young man on the lonely road back to town. "I've made myself decent," she said in a dry voice that didn't sound much like her own. "You may turn back if you like, Mr. Dearborn."
He did turn and gazed at her.
For a moment he said nothing, but she could see the look in his eyes well enough to know that he found her fair as well. And although this disquieted her, perhaps because of what he'd been whistling, she was also glad. Then he said, "You look well up there. You sit well." "And I shall have horses of my own to sit before long," she said. "Now the questions will come," she thought. But he only nodded, as though he had known this about her already, and began to walk toward town again. Feeling a little disappointed and not knowing exactly why, she clucked Sidemouth at Rusher and twitched her knees at him. He got moving, catching up with his master, who gave Rusher's muzzle a companionable little caress.
"What do they call that place yonder?" he asked, pointing at the derricks.
"The oil patch? Sitgo."
"Some of the derricks still pump?"
"Aye, and no way to stop them. Not that anyone still knows."
"Oh," he said. And that was all, just oh.
But he left his place by Rusher's head for a moment when they came to the weedy track leading into Sitgo, walking across to look at the old disused guard hut. In her childhood there had been a sign on it reading "Authorized Personnel Only," but it had blown away in some windstorm or other. Will Dearborn had his look, and then came ambling back to the horse, boots puffing up summer dust, easy in his new clothes. They went toward town, a young walking man in a flat-crowned hat, a young riding woman with a poncho spread over her lap and legs. The starlight rained down on them as it has on young men and women since time's first hour, and once she looked up and saw a meteor flash overhead, a brief and brilliant orange streak across the vault of heaven. Susan thought to wish on it, and then, with something like panic, realized she had no idea what to wish for. None at all. 4. She kept her own silence until they were a mile or so from town, and then asked the question which had been on her mind. She had planned to ask hers after he had begun asking his, and it irked her to be the one to break the silence, but in the end her curiosity was too much. "Where do you come from, Mr. Dearborn? And what brings you to our little bit of mid-world, if you don't mind me asking?"
"Not at all," he said, looking up at her with a smile. "I'm glad to talk, and was only trying to think how to begin. Talk's not a specialty of mine."
"Then what is Will Dearborn?" she wondered. Yeah, she wondered very much, for in adjusting her position on the saddle, she had put her hand on the rolled blanket behind, and had touched something hidden inside that blanket, something that felt like a gun. It didn't have to be, of course, but she remembered the way his hands had dropped instinctively toward his belt when she had cried out in surprise.
"I come from the in-world. I've an idea you probably guessed that much on your own. We have our own way of talking."
"Aye. Which barony is your home, might I ask?"
"New Canaan."
She felt a flash of real excitement at that. New Canaan, center of the affiliation. That did not mean all at once had, of course, but still.
Not Gilead? She asked,
detesting the hint of a girlish gush she heard in her voice. And more than just a hint, mayhap. No, he said with a laugh, nothing so grand as Gilead. Only Hemphill, a village 40 or so wheels west of there, smaller than Hambry, I wot.
Wheels, she thought, marveling at the archaism. He said wheels. And what brings you to Hambry, then, may you tell?
Why not? I've come with two of my friends, Mr. Richard Stockworth of Pendleton, New Canaan, and Mr. Arthur Heath, a hilarious young man who actually does come from Gilead. We're here at the Order of the Affiliation and have come as counters.
Counters of what?
Counters of anything and everything which may aid the affiliation in the coming years, he said, and she heard no lightness in his voice now. The business with the good man has grown serious.
Has it? We hear little real news this far to the south and east of the hub.
He nodded. The barony's distance from the hub is the chief reason we're here. Magus has been ever loyal to the affiliation, and if supplies need to be drawn from this part of the outers, they'll be sent. The question that needs answering is how much the affiliation can count on.
How much of what?
Yes, he agreed, as if she'd made a statement instead of asking a question, and how much of what?
You speak as though the good man were a real threat. He's just a bandit, surely, frosting his thefts and murders with talk of democracy and equality.
Dearborn shrugged, and she thought for a moment that would be his only comment on the matter, but then he said reluctantly, "'Twas once so, perhaps. Times have changed. At some point the bandit became a general, and now the general would become a ruler in the name of the people." He paused, then added gravely, "The northern and western baronies are in flames, lady."
"But those are thousands of miles away, surely."
This talk was upsetting, and yet strangely exciting, too. Mostly it seemed exotic, after the pokey, all-days-the-same world of Hambry, where someone's dry well was good for 3 days of animated conversation.
"Yes," he said, not I, but yes, the sound was both strange and pleasing to her ear. "But the wind is blowing in this direction." He turned to her and smiled. Once more it softened his hard, good looks, and made him seem no more than a child, up too late after his bedtime.
"But I don't think we'll see John Farson tonight, do you?" She smiled back.
"If we did, Mr. Dearborn, would you protect me from him?"
"No doubt," he said, still smiling. "But I should do so with greater enthusiasm, I wot, if you were to let me call you by the name your father gave you."
"Then, in the interest of my own safety, you may do so. And I suppose I must call you Will, in those same interests."
"'Tis both wise and prettily put," he said, the smile becoming a grin, wide and engaging. "I..." Then, walking as he was with his face turned back and up to her, Susan's new friend tripped over a rock jutting out of the road and almost fell. Rusher whinnied through his nose and reared a little. Susan laughed merrily. The poncho shifted, revealing one bare leg, and she took a moment before putting matters right again. She liked him. Aye, so she did. And what harm could there be in it? He was only a boy, after all. When he smiled, she could see he was only a year or two removed from jumping in haystacks. The thought that she had recently graduated from haystack jumping herself had somehow fled her mind. "I'm usually not clumsy," he said. "I hope I didn't startle you."
"Not at all, Will. Boys have been stubbing their toes around me ever since I grew my breasts." "Not at all," she said, and returned to the previous topic. It interested her greatly. "So ye and your friends come at the behest of the affiliation to count our goods, do you?"
"Yes. The reason I took particular note of yon oil patch is because one of us will have to come back and count the working derricks."
"I can spare you that, Will. There are 19.
He nodded. "I'm in your debt. But we'll also need to make out, if we can, how much oil those 19 pumps are bringing up. Are there so many oil-fired machines still working in New Canaan that such news matters? And do you have the alchemy to change the oil into the stuff your machines can use?
It's called refinery, rather than alchemy in this case, at least I think so. And I believe there is one that still works. But no, we haven't that many machines. Although there are still a few working filament lights in the Great Hall at Gilead.
Fancy it, she said, delighted. She had seen pictures of filament lights and electric flambeau, but never the lights themselves.
The last ones in Hambry, they had been called spark lights in this part of the world, but she felt sure they were the same, had burned out 2 generations ago.
You said your father managed the mayor's horses until his death, Will Dearborn said. Was his name Patrick Delgado? It was, wasn't it?
She looked down at him, badly startled and brought back to reality in an instant.
How do you know that?
His name was in our lessons of calling. We're to count cattle, sheep, pigs, oxen, and horses. Of all your livestock, horses are the most important. Patrick Delgado was the man we were to see in that regard. I'm sorry to hear he's come to the clearing at the end of the path, Susan. Will you accept my condolence?
Aye, and with thanks.
Was it an accident?
Aye.
Hoping her voice said what she wanted it to say, which was leave this subject, ask no more.
Let me be honest with you, he said. And for the first time she thought she heard a false note there. Perhaps it was only her imagination. Certainly she had little experience of the world. Aunt Cord reminded her of this almost daily. But she had an idea that people who sat on by saying, let me be honest with you, were apt to go on by telling you straight-faced that rain fell up, money grew on trees, and babies were brought by the Grand Featherex.
Aye, Will Dearborn, she said, her tone just the tiniest bit dry.
They say honesty's the best policy, so they do.
He looked at her a bit doubtfully, and then his smile shone out again.
That smile was dangerous, she thought. A quicksand smile, if ever there was one. Easy to wander in, perhaps more difficult to wander back out.
There's not much affiliation in the affiliation these days. That's part of the reason Farson's gone on as long as he has. That's what has allowed his ambitions to grow. He's come a far way from the Harrier who began as a stage robber in Garland and DeSoy, and he'll come farther yet if the affiliation isn't revitalized, maybe all the way to Mages. She couldn't imagine what the good man could possibly want with her own sleepy little town in the barony which lay closest to the clean sea, but she kept silent.
In any case, it wasn't really the affiliation that sent us, he said.
Not all this way to count cows and oil derricks and hectares of land under cultivation. He paused a moment, looking down the road, as if for more rocks in the way of his boots, and stroking Rusher's nose with absent-minded gentleness. She thought he was embarrassed, perhaps even shamed. We were sent by our fathers. Then she understood. Bad boys they were, sent out on a make-work quest that wasn't quite exile. She guessed their real job in Hambry might be to rehabilitate their reputations.
Well, she thought, it certainly explains the quicksand smile, doesn't it? Wear this one, Susan. He's the sort to burn bridges and upset mail carts, then go on his merry way without a single look back. Not in meanness, but in plain old boy carelessness.
That made her think of the old song again, the one she'd been singing, the one he'd been whistling.
Our fathers, yes.
Susan Delgado had cut a caper or two, or perhaps it was 2 dozen of her own in her time, and she felt sympathy for Will Dearborn as well as caution. And interest. Bad boys could be amusing, up to a point. The question was, how bad had Will and his cronies been?
Helling?
She asked. Helling, he agreed, still sounding glum, but perhaps brightening just a bit about the eyes and mouth.
We were warned.
Yes, warned very well. There was a certain amount of drinking.
And a few girls to squeeze with the hand not busy squeezing the ale pot?
It was a question no nice girl could outright ask, but one that couldn't help occurring to her mind. Now the smile, which had played briefly around the corners of his mouth, dropped away.
We pushed it too far, and the fun stopped. Fools have a way of doing that. One night there was a race, one moonless night. After midnight, all of us drunk. One of the horses caught his hoof in a gopher hole and snapped a foreleg. He had to be put down. Susan winced. It wasn't the worst thing she could think of, but bad enough. And when he opened his mouth again, it got worse. The horse was a thoroughbred, one of just three owned by my friend Richard's father, who is not well-to-do. There were scenes in our households which I haven't any desire to remember, let alone talk about. I'll make a long story short and say that after much talk and many proposals for punishment, we were sent here on this errand. It was Arthur's father's idea. I think Arthur's dad has always been a bit appalled by Arthur. Certainly Arthur's ructions didn't come from George Heath's side. Susan smiled to herself, thinking of Aunt Cordelia saying she certainly doesn't get it from our side of the family. Then the calculated pause, followed by, "She had a great aunt on her mother's side who ran crazy. You didn't know? Yes. Set herself on fire and threw herself over the drop. In the year of the comet it was." "Anyway," Will resumed, "Mr. Heath set us on with a saying from his own father. One should meditate in purgatory. And here we are."
"Hambry's far from purgatory."
He sketched his funny little bow again. "If it were, all should want to be bad enough to come here and meet the pretty denizens."
"Work on that one a bit," she said in her driest voice. "It's still rough, I fear. Perhaps..."
She fell silent as a dismaying realization occurred to her. She was going to have to hope this boy would enter into a limited conspiracy with her, otherwise she was apt to be embarrassed.
"Susan?" "I was just thinking. Are you here yet, Will? Officially, I mean."
"No," he said, taking her meaning at once, and likely already seeing where this was going. He seemed sharp enough in his way. "We only arrived in Barony this afternoon, and you're the first person any of us has spoken to. Unless that is Richard and Arthur have met folks. I couldn't sleep, and so came out to ride and to think things over a little. We're camped over there." He pointed to the right, "on that long slope that runs toward the sea."
"Aye, the drop, it's called."
She realized that Will and his mates might even be camped on what would be her own land by law before much more time had passed. The thought was amusing and exciting and a little startling. "Tomorrow we ride into town and present our compliments to my Lord Mayor Hart Thorin. He's a bit of a fool, according to what we were told before leaving New Canaan."
"Were you indeed told so?"
she asked, raising one eyebrow.
"Yes. Apt to blabber, fond of strong drink, even more fond of young girls," Will said. "Is it true, would you say?"
"I think ye must judge for yourself," said she, stifling a smile with some effort.
"In any case, we'll also be presenting to the Honorable Kimba Reimer, Thorin's Chancellor, and I understand he knows his beans, and counts his beans as well."
"Thorin will have you to dinner at Mayor's house," Susan said. "Perhaps not tomorrow night, but surely the night after."
"A dinner of state in Hambry," Will said, smiling and still stroking Rusher's nose. "Gods, how shall I bear the agony of my anticipation?"
"Never mind your nettlesome mouth," she said, "but only listen if he'd be my friend. This is important."
His smile dropped away, and she saw again, as she had for a moment or two before, the man he'd be before too many more years had passed. The hard face, the concentrated eyes, the merciless mouth. It was a frightening face, in a way, a frightening prospect. And yet, still, the place the old hag had touched felt warm, and she found it difficult to take her eyes off him. What, she wondered, was his hair like under that stupid hat he wore?
"Tell me, Susan. If you and your friends come to table at Thorin's, you may see me. If you see me, Will, see me for the first time. See Miss Delgado as I shall see Mr. Dearborn. Do we take my meaning?"
"To the letter." He was looking at her thoughtfully. "Do you serve? Surely if your father was the barony's chief drover, you do not..."
"Never mind what I do or don't do. Just promise that if we meet at Seafront, we meet for the first time."
"I promise," But no more questions. We've nearly come to the place where we must part ways, and I want to give you a warning. Fair payment for the ride on this nice mount of yours, mayhap. If ye dine with Thorin and Rhymer, ye'll not be the only new folk at his table. There'll likely be three others, men Thorin has hired to serve as private guards of the house.
Not as sheriff's deputies?
Nay, they answer to none but Thorin, or mayhap to Rhymer. Their names are Jonas, DePape, and Reynolds. They look like hard boys to me, although Jonas's boyhood is so long behind him that I imagine he's forgot he ever had one.
Jonas is the leader?
Aye. He limps, has hair that falls to his shoulders, pretty as any girl's, and the quavery voice of an old gaffer who spends his days polishing the chimney corner. But I think he's the most dangerous of the three all the same. I'd guess these three have forgot more about Helling than you and your friends will ever learn. Now, why had she told him all that? She didn't know exactly. Gratitude, perhaps. He had promised to keep the secret of this late-night meeting, and he had the look of a promise-keeper, in hack with his father or not.
I'll watch them, and I thank you for the advice. They were now climbing a long, gentle slope. Overhead, old mother blazed relentlessly. Bodyguards, he mused. Bodyguards in sleepy little Hambry. It's strange times, Susan. Strange indeed.
Aye.
She had wondered about Jonas, DePape, and Reynolds herself, and could think of no good reason for them to be in town. Had they been Rhymer's doing, Rhymer's decision? It seemed likely. Thorin wasn't the sort of man to even think about bodyguards, she would have said. The High Sheriff had always done well enough for him. But still, why? They breasted the hill. Below them lay a nestle of buildings, the village of Hambry. Only a few lights still shone. The brightest cluster marked the Traveler's Rest. From here on the warm breeze, she could hear the piano beating out Hey Jude and a score of drunken voices gleefully murdering the chorus. Not the three men of whom she had warned Will Dearborn, though. They would be standing at the bar, watching the room with their flat eyes. Not the singing type were those three. Each had a small blue coffin shape tattooed on his right hand, burned into the webbing between thumb and forefinger. She thought to tell Will this, then realized he'd see for himself soon enough. Instead, she pointed a little way down the slope at a dark shape which overhung the road on a chain.
Do you see that?
Yes. He heaved a large and rather comical sigh. Is it the object I fear beyond all others? Is it the dread shape of Mrs. Beach's mailbox?
Aye, and it's there we must part.
If you say we must, we must.
Yet I wish...
Just then the wind shifted, as it sometimes did in the summer, and blew a strong gust out of the west. The smell of sea salt was gone in an instant, and so was the sound of the drunken singing voices. What replaced them was a sound infinitely more sinister, one that never failed to produce a scutter of goose flesh up her back. A low, atonal noise, like the warble of a siren being turned by a man without much longer to live. Will took a step backward, eyes widening, and again she noticed his hands take a dip toward his belt, as if reaching for something not there.
What in God's name is that?
It's a thinny, she said quietly. In Eyebolt Canyon. Have you never heard of such?
Heard of, yes, but never heard until now. Gods, how do you stand it? It sounds alive.
She had never thought of it quite like that. But now, in a way listening with his ears instead of her own, she thought he was right. It was as if some sick part of the night had gained a voice and was actually trying to sing. She shivered.
Rusher felt the momentary increased pressure of her knees and whickered softly, craning his head around to look at her.
"We don't often hear it so clearly at this time of year," she said. "In the fall the men burn it to quiet."
I don't understand. Who did? Who understood anything anymore? Gods, they couldn't even turn off the few oil pumps in Sitco that still worked, although half of them squealed like pigs in a slaughtering chute. These days you were usually just grateful to find things that still worked at all.
In the summer, when there's time, drovers and cowboys drag loads of brush to the mouth of Eyebolt, she said. Dead brush is all right, but live is better, for it's smoke that's wanted, and the heavier the better. Eyebolt's a box canyon, very short and steep-walled, almost like a chimney lying on its side, you see?
Yes.
The traditional time for burning is reap morn, the day after the fair and the feast and the fire.
The first day of winter.
Aye. Although in these parts it doesn't feel like winter so soon. In any case, it's no tradition. The brush is sometimes lit sooner if the winds have been prankish or if the sound's particularly strong. It upsets the livestock, you know. Cows give poorly when the noise of the thinny's strong, and it makes sleep difficult.
I should think it would.
Will was still looking north, and a stronger gust of wind blew his hat off. It fell to his back, the rawhide tug string pulling against the line of his throat. The hair, so revealed, was a little long and as black as a crow's wing. She felt a sudden, greedy desire to run her hands through it, to let her fingers tell its texture, rough or smooth or silky, and how would it smell? At this, she felt another shiver of heat down low in her belly. He turned to her as though he had read her mind, and she flushed, grateful that he wouldn't be able to see the darkening of her cheek.
How long has it been there?
Since before I was born, she said, but not before my dad was born. He said that the ground shook in an earthquake just before it came. Some say the earthquake brought it, some say that's superstitious nonsense. All I know is that it's always been there. The smoke quiets it a while, the way it will quiet a hive of bees or wasps, but the sound always comes back. The brush piled at the mouth helps to keep any wandering livestock out, too. Sometimes they're drawn to it, gods know why. But if a cow or sheep does happen to get in, after the burning and before the next year's pile has started to grow, mayhap, it doesn't come back out. Whatever it is, it's hungry.
She put his poncho aside, lifted her right leg over the saddle without so much as touching the horn, and slipped off Rusher. All this in a single liquid movement. It was a stunt made for pants rather than a dress, and she knew from the further widening of his eyes that he'd seen a good lot of her. But nothing she had to wash with the bathroom door closed, so what of that? And that quick dismount had ever been a favorite trick of hers when she was in a show-offy mood.
"Pretty," he exclaimed. "I learned it from my dad," she said, responding to the more innocent interpretation of his compliment. Her smile, as she handed him the reins, however, suggested that she was willing to accept the compliment any way it was meant.
"Susan, have you ever seen the thinny?"
"Aye, once or twice, from above."
"What does it look like?"
"Ugly," she responded at once.
Until tonight, when she had observed Rhea's smile up close and endured her twiddling, meddling fingers, she would have said it was the ugliest thing she had ever seen.
"It looks a little like a slow-burning peat fire, and a little like a swamp full of scummy green water. There's a mist that rises off it. Sometimes it looks like long, skinny arms, with hands at the end of them."
"Is it growing?"
"Aye. They say it is, that every thinny grows. But it grows slowly. 'Twon't escape Eyebolt Canyon in your time or mine."
She looked up at the sky and saw that the constellations had continued to tilt along their tracks as they spoke. She felt she could talk to him all night, about the thinny or Sitgo or her irritating aunt, or just about anything. And the idea dismayed her. Why should this happen to her now, for the gods' sake? After 3 years of dismissing the Hambry boys, why should she now meet a boy who interested her so strangely? Why was life so unfair? Her earlier thought, the one she'd heard in her father's voice, recurred to her. "If it's Ka, it'll come like a wind, and your plans will stand before it no more than a barn before a cyclone."
But no, and no, and no.
So set she, with all her considerable determination, her mind against the idea. This was no barn. This was her life. Susan reached out and touched the rusty tin of Mrs. Beach's mailbox, as if to steady herself in the world.
Her little hopes and daydreams didn't mean so much, perhaps, but her father had taught her to measure herself by her ability to do the thing she'd said she would do, and she would not overthrow his teachings simply because she happened to encounter a good-looking boy at a time when her body and her emotions were in a stew. "I'll leave you here to either rejoin your friends or resume your ride," she said. The gravity she heard in her voice made her feel a bit sad, for it was an adult gravity. "But remember your promise, Will. If ye see me at Seafront, Mayor's house, and if ye'd be my friend, see me there for the first time, as I'd see you." He nodded, and she saw her seriousness now mirrored in his own face, and the sadness, mayhap. "I've never asked a girl to ride out with me, or if she'd accept a visit of me. I'd ask of you, Susan, daughter of Patrick. I'd even bring you flowers to sweeten my chances. But it would do no good, I think." She shook her head.
"Nay, 'twouldn't."
"Are you promised in marriage? It's forward of me to ask, I know, but I mean no harm."
"I'm sure you don't, but I'd as soon not answer. My position is a delicate one just now, as I told you. Besides, it's late. Here's where we part, Will. But stay one more moment."
She rummaged in the pocket of her apron and brought out half a cake wrapped in a piece of green leaf. The other half she had eaten on her way up to the coos, in what now felt like the other half of her life. She held what was left of her little evening meal out to Rusher, who sniffed it, then ate it and nuzzled her hand. She smiled, liking the velvet tickle in the cup of her palm.
"Aye, thee's a good horse, so ye are."
She looked at Will Dearborn, who stood in the road, shuffling his dusty boots and gazing at her unhappily. The hard look was gone from his face now. He looked her age again, or younger.
"We were well met, weren't we?" he asked.
She stepped forward, and before she could let herself think about what she was doing, she put her hands on his shoulders, stood on her toes, and kissed him on the mouth. The kiss was brief, but not sisterly.
"Aye, very well met, Will."
But when he moved toward her, as thoughtlessly as a flower turning its face to follow the sun, wishing to repeat the experience, she pushed him back a step, gently but firmly.
"Nay, that was only a thank you, and one thank you should be enough for a gentleman. Go your course in peace, Will."
He took up the reins like a man in a dream, looked at them for a moment as if he didn't know what in the world they were, and then looked back at her. She could see him working to clear his mind and emotions of the impact her kiss had made. She liked him for it, and she was very glad she had done it. "And you yours," he said, swinging into the saddle. "I look forward to meeting you for the first time." He smiled at her, and she saw both longing and wishes in that smile. Then he gigged the horse, turned him and started back the way they'd come, to have another look at the oil patch, mayhap. She stood where she was, by Mrs. Beach's mailbox, willing him to turn around and wave so she could see his face once more. She felt sure he would, but he didn't. Then, just as she was about to turn away and start down the hill to town, he did turn, and his hand lifted, fluttering for a moment in the dark like a moth. Susan lifted her own in return, and then went her way, feeling happy and unhappy at the same time. Yet, and this was perhaps the most important thing, she no longer felt soiled. When she had touched the boy's lips, Rhea's touch seemed to have left her skin. A small magic, perhaps, but she welcomed it. She walked on, smiling a little and looking up at the stars more frequently than was her habit when out after dark.